Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. Eating the right foods like fruits and vegetables and engaging in physical activity are two of the keys to staying healthy. Most of us know that, but then why then is it so difficult? According to the Centers for Disease Control, 36% of Americans are obese. Being overweight can lead to heart disease, stroke, type 2 diabetes, and contribute to some cancers. Again, that's not a secret, but many of us don't know what constitutes healthy choices in food and can't get motivated to eat healthy and exercise. And there are other factors that we're still learning about. The importance of good nutrition and physical activity today on Smart Talk. Joining us is Tamara Rhodes, outpatient clinical dietitian with UPMC Pinnacle. Ms. Rhodes, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
And by the way, if you are a regular listener to Smart Talk, I want to make you aware that UPMC Pinnacle is a financial supporter of the program. Also joining us is Dr. Janet Fulton, the chief of the Physical Activity and Health Branch of the Division of Nutrition, Physical Activity, and Obesity at the Centers for Disease Control. Dr. Fulton, welcome to the program.
My pleasure. Thanks, Scott.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532, or send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. I want to kind of ask some broad questions to begin with before we get into some of the latest findings and the latest discussions about diet, about nutrition, about physical exercise. Dr. Fulton, that statistic that I quoted from the CDC, 36% of Americans are obese. Just exactly what does that mean?
So, you know, in terms of the physical activity levels of Americans, we know that for adults, half of Americans are not getting the recommended amount of physical activity, and about three quarters of high school youth are not getting the same recommended amount of physical activity. So we have a lot of work to do to get the population moving and appropriately physically active, because we know it has enormous benefits for health. It's not just obesity that physical activity can benefit. It's a variety of well over 20 different chronic conditions, everything from heart disease to cancers to actually there's a lot more evidence now around brain health, depression, anxiety, even sleep and improvements in quality of life. So we like to think of as physical activity is kind of that magic pill that you can take because it has so many health benefits, and if you could package all those benefits in one pill, you'd make a lot of money.
So what is the recommended amount of physical activity?
Yeah, the recommended amount for adults is to do at least 150 minutes of moderate to vigorous physical activity each week. And that's to get kind of the basic health benefits, at least 150 minutes a week or 2.5 hours. To get even more benefit, adults can do 300 minutes or more of that same amount of physical activity. That's physical activity like taking a brisk walk. You know, it doesn't have to be jogging or running. It can be moderate intensity. Brisk walking is a great example. And those activities can be any kind of purpose. It can be walking to the bus stop. It could be dancing, you know, doing water aerobics. Any activity counts as long as it's at least moderate intensity. So that's for adults. And then for youth that are school age, it's kind of an easy thing to remember. It's an hour a day every day. And all those activities for kids really need to be age appropriate, and they need to be activities that youth enjoy.
I imagine that using the thumb on a video game is not considered physical activity.
It is not. You are correct.
And I mentioned that I will ask some basic questions. Define obesity. What is obesity in medical terms?
Yeah, obesity is in terms of a body mass index, it's having at least a body mass index that's at least 30 kilograms per meter squared. It's a very scientific, technical definition, but really it just means having too much body fat, that's detrimental to health.
Tamara Rhodes, let's talk about, let's move to the other side now, the diet side of it. But before we do, when we start talking about some specifics, what trends do you see when we're talking about obesity, when we're talking about Americans, in your case, Pennsylvanians, that you see? What kind of trends are you seeing as far as weight and health?
I see a lot of trends as far as a link between weight and other types of chronic disease. So obesity is considered in many situations to be a chronic condition, and it often overlaps with other types of chronic disease. Right now we know that 45% of American adults have at least one chronic disease, and those are the number one killer in the Western world. Like two-thirds of deaths every year are related to one of five chronic diseases.
So which are?
They are stroke, they are cardiovascular disease, they are type 2 diabetes, COPD, and the other one I'm blanking on.
Cancer?
Cancer, yes. I don't know why I was thinking that. But yeah, so oftentimes I see people with multiple chronic diseases who are coming into my office trying to control this myriad of distress that their body is in some way. And because it has become their new normal. So they don't realize how much their body may be affected by their day-to-day choices.
Okay, those choices. This is another broad question, but mm-hmm. What does a healthy diet look like today?
So I'm a big believer that a healthy diet looks different for everybody. An example that I would give for that would be if I have somebody walk into my office and say, I'd really like to lower my cholesterol, I could recommend eating 4 to 7 ounces of tree nuts per week. If I have somebody else walk into my office and say, I have a tree nut allergy, well, then that's not going to be an appropriate recommendation for them. In terms of preventing chronic disease and treating it, the baseline recommendations I would give across the board and would apply to all ages would be a diet that is high in fiber. Fiber is the part of the plant that your body does not digest. We know that 95% of Americans do not get enough fiber.
So fruit and vegetables?
Any plant-based food.
Okay.
So fruits and vegetables, but also legumes, nuts, seeds, whole grains. Also high in omega-3 fatty acids. Omega-3 fatty acids are an essential fatty acid, so we have to get them from our diet, and our body cannot synthesize them. They're not very plentiful in our food supply, but they are very, very strong anti-inflammatory.
I know
foods.
I'm jumping around on you, and we're going to talk about anti-inflammatories in just a moment, but when you give us some examples of some foods with omega-3 fatty acids. Yes.
Any of your fatty fish, so things like salmon, things like black cod, tuna, herring, halibut, chia seeds, flaxseed, walnuts are another good source of omega-3s. And your most consistent bioavailable omega-3s are going to be in fatty fish.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Folden talked about the not getting enough exercise. And as you said, 95% of Americans don't get the kind of fiber that we need.
Correct.
Why not?
I think it's because our food system has gravitated more towards refined grains, processed grains. We're looking for more ready-to-eat, convenience foods. Many people have the perspective that eating vegetables or eating beans is too expensive or it is too time-consuming to sit down and prepare that meal, to buy everything, chop everything, prepare it in a way that's appealing to you. And we have gradually shifted to more not only convenience foods and ready-to-eat foods, but heavily processed foods.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Folden, I want to ask you to weigh in on that as well. I mean, we've kind of established from the two of you that Americans are not getting enough exercise, not getting enough healthy food. I mean, obviously, our lifestyles have a lot to do with it. Probably advertising of the kind of foods that we see makes us eat those kind of things. I say make us. We make those choices. But So what's happening? And as I said in my introduction, most Americans know this, But what keeps us from doing it?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I think most people, when in most surveys you look at, people have the knowledge. You know, we're a public health agency at the CDC, and we really believe that everyone should have the opportunity to have a safe and easy place to be physically active. So we need to think about how communities are designed to promote physical activity and make it really easy and safe for everyone to be physically active. You know, people should be able to walk or bicycle to work or to school. They should have those amenities in their neighborhoods. They should have sidewalks and crosswalks and appropriate lighting that makes it easy for people to walk outside their door, either go for a walk for recreation or be able to walk to work or to walk to a restaurant or walk to the grocery store. So those are some of the potential solutions to promoting physical activity more widely in the population.
We have a phone call from Barry in Lancaster. Barry, you're on the air.
Oh, it's Larry.
Oh, it's Larry? Okay, sorry.
I'm calling. Okay. I'm actually out running at the moment, but let me take a break. This is directed to the CDC person, and I'm wondering what the heart rate thresholds are for moderate exercise and intense exercise.
All right. Thank you very much for your call, Dr. Fulton.
Yeah, thanks, Larry. That's a great question. So one of the easy ways that we recommend people get at least moderate intensity physical activity, and sounds like you are doing that right now, is the talk test. And so if you can, we'd want you to be able to talk but not sing while you're being physically active. So that's one way to gauge it while you're actually being physically active. There are other more complicated ways to gauge around percentage of maximal heart rate and things like that. But I think the talk test is a really easy way that everybody can gauge their intensity of physical activity.
But, you know, the question about, there's some people who are really into exercise. They do look at heart rates and that kind of thing. Quickly, what would a good heart rate be for intense exercise and exercise that is beneficial but maybe not as intense?
Sure. So it depends on your maximal heart rate, which is estimated as 220 minus your age. And it's typically around 50% of that number. So if you're 20 years old and you're 200 minus 20, that's 100 beats a minute.
Okay. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. To learn more about healthy lifestyles, eating healthy, exercise, plus a deeper look at the changing tide of healthcare, check out WITF's Transforming Health. From policy to personal choices, we're taking a comprehensive look at today's health system. Online at transforminghealth.org, a partnership of WITF, Penn State Health, and WhaleSpan Health. Our guest for this portion of today's program is Dr. Janet Fulton, the Chief of the Physical Activity and Health Branch of the Division of Nutrition, Physical Activity, and Obesity at the Centers for Disease Control, and Tamara Rhodes, an outpatient clinician, clinical dietitian with UPMC Pinnacle. If you have questions or comments, 1-800-729-7532 is the number to call, or send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Tamara Rhodes, there has been a lot of talk lately about chronic inflammation as it relates to healthy lifestyles as far as diet goes and even exercise. Chronic inflammation is probably not the first thing that many people think of when it comes to those two areas. How does it relate?
That's a really good question. So chronic inflammation is getting so much attention in the health sector at this time because we know that inflammation is, at least in part, at the root of all chronic diseases. As our population is living longer, as our food system, our environments are changing, we are exposed to more and more pro-inflammatory behaviors and compounds. So chronic inflammation, I'm just going to take you back to high school chemistry class for a moment. inflammation is initiated when the body is made up of atoms. An atom is considered unstable, so it's called a free radical. Free radicals can be caused by UV light. They could be caused by cigarette smoke. They can also be caused by certain food choices. They can be caused by sedentary lifestyles, not enough sleep. And that free radical does not have, it's surrounded by an orbit or a shell of electrons. A free radical does not have a full shell. So that makes it very highly chemically reactive. And its goal is to seek out another atom that it can steal an electron from. That in turn creates a domino effect that results in cellular tissue, cellular damage that accumulates over time and eventually disrupts the living organism.
So, you know, when I think of inflammation, and probably there are a lot of other people who think of this too, they're thinking on the body, on the skin, that I have inflammation from, you know, a scratch, a bee sting, something like that. So you kind of went through this, but how does that contribute your choices in diet? How does that contribute to, you know, problems with you know, how big you become or how much fat you have on your body, your BMI, chronic disease? You're saying that it contributes a great deal to chronic disease.
So I think you're exactly right. A lot of people, when they think of inflammation, they think of, oh, I sprained my ankle or I broke a bone. And at its acute stages, inflammation is a necessary process to repair and heal tissue damage. With chronic inflammation, that results in overactivity of the immune system for a prolonged period of time. After a while, the white blood cells, the immunosensitive compounds are really starting to attack healthy tissue. And that healthy tissue destruction is where that chronic inflammation comes in, because chronic inflammation tends to lead to more free radical production. And the more inflammation that we have going on, the higher the risk of many chronic illnesses, in the sense that high blood sugars, high blood lipids, your cholesterol, your triglycerides, high levels of CRP, C-reactive protein, all of those are biomarkers of inflammation. A big contributor to the control of the free radicals is going to be your antioxidant intake. So antioxidants are... this is where our fruits and vegetables really come in. And I know it probably sounds redundant to say, eat your fruits and vegetables, but an anti-inflammatory diet, a diet that's going to combat this free radical production, is going to have 5 to 9 servings of fruits and vegetables per day. And our fruits and vegetables are going to be very rich in vitamin C, vitamin E, vitamin or beta carotene, all of which scavenge for those free radicals and donate an electron. So the free radical becomes stable. It stops that chain reaction. We know that, to correlate it with your question about weight, we know that the more inflammation somebody has, the more likely they are to be insulin resistant. Insulin resistance is associated with increasing blood sugars, which is also associated with more appetite, more weight gain. And so it becomes a cycle, so to speak. To clarify what I was talking about with the omega-3 fatty acids, the omega-3 fatty acids are very anti-inflammatory, but they have a counterpart that is very pro-inflammatory, which are omega-6 fatty acids. Omega-6 fatty acids are found in a lot of snack foods, processed foods, fast foods, mostly are vegetable oil sources like corn oil, soybean oil, which many people estimate takes up like 20% of the average American's daily calorie intake. These initiate prothrombotic, proconstrictive, pro-inflammatory processes that influence physical and mental health.
Let's take some phone calls. Let's go to Heather in Lingolstown. Heather, you're on the air.
Hi. I think that, exercise is definitely one of the things that contribute to weight gain. But the main thing is the processed foods and the cost compared to your fruits and vegetables. I would love to feed my family lots of fruits and vegetables every day. If the cost wasn't, you know, double or 75% more of what it takes for me to, you know, go out and get, you know, hot dogs, a pack of hot dogs, some buns, some mac and cheese, and feed that. Yes, I understand it's way less healthy, but it's what people can afford to feed their families. And we're not even going in and putting in, you know, the cost, the time constraints that add cost to it. To cook a meal at home with fruits and vegetables is way more expensive, not only on the money side, but the time side, than me hurrying up and grabbing something after working a 12, 14, 16-hour day to take care of my family. So those are all things that need to be fixed.
All right. Thank you very much for your call. I'll ask both of you to weigh in on that. You know, she's got a point. Many families, cost is a factor.
Sure, absolutely. I think that cost and time are two of the biggest barriers that people encounter. As far as making a plant-based diet more cost-effective, there are a lot of steps that you can take. There's more and more food options out there that make it so that you're not coming home with a grocery bill that's double what you would spend otherwise. Using frozen vegetables that don't have any seasoning, sauces, those are going to be very cheap, and they also are already prepared for you. A lot of the time, all you have to do is put them in the microwave and steam them. In regard to whole grains are usually the same price as refined grains. In regard, you mentioned the hot dogs, and many people are thinking, oh, that's a source of protein, a cheap source of protein. I would encourage you to look at high fiber protein options, which are, again, going to be exclusively plant-based, and that would be things like beans, lentils. Those are ready to eat. You can get a can of beans, you rinse it off, drain it well, and you have an easy source of protein with your meal for less than a dollar a can.
Dr. Fulton, I think that Heather, the caller, brought up a perfect example. It was a perfect example of what we were talking about. Not enough time, but also bringing money into the occasion as into the conversation as well.
Yeah, it's a really good point that Heather brought up. And I think on the physical activity side, that's, you know, you don't have to join a gym to get the health benefits of physical activity. You can lace up your comfortable shoes and go for a walk. You can walk to the bus stop. You know, you can do these things that don't really require a large amount of investment. You know, it's definitely a resource investment in terms of, you know, making sure you take the time to do it, but you can actually invest in your health by taking, you know, 10-minute walks, you know, throughout the day. That's a great investment in your health. And I think from an investment standpoint, you know, those investments, you know, in terms of, you know, eating well and moving more are really going to pay off in the long run.
Let's go to Vincent in Snyder County. Vincent, you're on the air.
Yes. I had a question regarding the bouncing of weight, you know, losing a lot of weight and then turning around and gaining it right back, or even going above it. I've lost over 100 pounds, and I gained quite a bit of it back over the last couple years. And it doesn't seem like I overeat. Is there any other causes that, you know, that might, you know, I know that's a thing that a lot of Americans have to deal with constantly, is that, you know, they'll lose the weight and then they actually gain it plus a little bit more.
Vincent, let me ask you this question. I mean, do you go on any kind of specific diets, and does that contribute to this going up and down?
No, and that, you know, I that's the thing is, I don't have a specific diet. You know, just the general trying to look at what containers say now and again and try to minimize the fat content and the carbohydrates a little bit. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, a lot of times it seems like I'm not, I mean, I'll try to eat to the point where I just don't feel hungry, you know, I'm not hungry anymore, but at the same time, like, you know, I don't think the calorie content that I'm consuming is
that much different. Mm-hmm. All right, thank you very much for your call, Ms. Rhodes. What about that, that yo-yo effect, as he calls it?
The weight cycling we are finding is, and that rebound weight gain is a very, very common problem. And that's due to a couple of different things. The primary reason I see behind that is as we get older, we lose lean body mass if we aren't actively trying to prevent it. So a lot of people may go for a run, go for a bike ride. They're doing great cardio, but they're not doing any strength training, any resistance training to maintain their lean body mass. If somebody is cutting their calories too significantly, the body is going to use the lean body mass as a source of fuel. That's a very expensive source of fuel. And the long-term effects of that, which is where a lot of the rebound weight gain can come in, is if you have lost a significant amount of lean body mass, that is going to slow down your metabolism markedly. So once you get to your goal weight, whatever that may be, your metabolism, if your calories have been cut too much or if your body has used its own muscle to fuel the activities of your daily life, your metabolism is going to be much slower. You are going to process calories at a much slower, less efficient rate, which can lead to weight gain and seemingly excess calorie intake to your body, even if you aren't actually increasing your calorie intake.
And this is Janet. That's one thing that I should mention as well as part of the guidelines for physical activity. It's not just aerobic physical activity. It's also muscle strengthening activities for adults at least twice a week, and then for school age youth, it's at least 3 days a week. Mm-hmm. So I think what Tamara brings up is really an important issue, especially as we age.
One quick final question, Tamara, and if I could ask for a quick answer.
Sure.
Is there a test that can be added that would be useful in addressing system inflammation?
System-wide inflammation, the best markers of inflammation are either CRP, your C-reactive protein, or your sedimentation rate. Those aren't necessarily appropriate for everybody in every situation, but those are considered the best serological evidence that can produce.
You ask your doctor about that, your family doctor, they would know what you're talking about.
Absolutely.
Okay. I see we have a lot of phone calls. Unfortunately, we're running out of time. We'll have to visit this topic again in the near future. Tamara Rhodes, outpatient clinical dietitian with UPMC Pinnacle. Dr. Janet Fulton, the chief of the physical activity and health branch of the Division of Nutrition, Physical Activity and Obesity at the Centers for Disease Control. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Scott.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. Our conversations with the candidates continue today with Democrat Eric Ding, who is running for the U.S. House of Representatives in the 10th Congressional District. The 10th Congressional District covers Dauphin County, eastern Cumberland County, and the northern portion of York County. There are four Democrats competing in the May 15th primary. The winner faces Republican incumbent Congressman Scott Perry. Joining us is Dr. Eric Ding. Dr. Ding, thank you for joining us today, being with us.
Very happy to be here. Thank you so much.
So tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I grew up in Cumberland County, elementary, middle, high school. I'm a Chinese immigrant, but I am a product of Pennsylvania public education. And my mother's a teacher. My father was a factory worker who worked in Cumberland County until he was laid off when the factory closed. And I survived a very unique bout with a large tumor, and the doctors at Hershey Medical Center saved my life when originally I was given less than 5 years to live. And I dedicated my career afterwards to public health. I went to Johns Hopkins, I went to Harvard, and earned two doctorates in public health, nutrition and epidemiology. And as a career public health scientist, I've worked with building a 6 million person cancer campaign, fundraising for cancer research and doing cancer prevention education. And I've also taken on the drug industry. I've held major companies like Merck accountable when their drug Vioxx many years ago was hurting the public. And and many other things like toxin alert to prevent lead poisoning in other communities after the Flint lead poisoning tragedy. So my entire career as a public health scientist has been solving public health problems. And in Pennsylvania, my career has been evolved based on my public education in Pennsylvania and inspired by my teachers. So this is why I am very, very dedicated to issues in Pennsylvania. And my parents are still here, and I'm still solving issues in Pennsylvania today.
I've heard you speak. Last week, I moderated a debate, you and your Democratic opponents, and I heard you say that healthcare, if elected, that healthcare would be your number one priority. Why?
Well, you can't even have a meaningful economy without healthcare, because healthcare, I would say, is the central nexus around which an economy and a community evolves. With health, there nothing else matters, as many people say. And if you want a healthy workforce, you need a workforce that's able-bodied to work. And similarly, if you want a workforce, you need a society that's not being decimated by the opioid epidemic. And people need that safety net. And healthcare is something, it's also a human right. It's not just a safety net, it's a human right, because if someone has, you know, first of all, workers should not have to worry about losing the health insurance and for their child to suffer if they got laid off from a factory, like my father did. And seniors should not have to decide between food on the plate and seeing their doctor. And families should not have to worry about going bankrupt if their child has cancer. And all these things happened to my family to some degree. And it's basically all centered around healthcare, because I'm here, first of all, because of good, affordable health insurance. And my mother, who's a 25-year union teacher, it's because of her union that actually allowed me to have good healthcare after my father was laid off. And so much of our economy, you know, say a father of four, he has broken back, but he didn't have health insurance, and he needs to fix his back to go back to work. Well, if he needs to fix his back to go back to work, he needs health insurance. But you don't want to get caught in a catch-22 where if you don't have health insurance, you can't get back to work, right? Because you need to go back to work. And if work is the only requirement for healthcare, then basically he would be stuck at home, jobless, his family would suffer, they'd be on disability and other food stamps, and that's actually a longer-term drag. It costs more to the economy if you don't solve these healthcare issues. And
so you support universal healthcare, don't you?
Yes. There's many forms of universal healthcare, and those things can be debated in a longer policy setting, and I don't want to bore readers here, but healthcare is a fundamental right. People should at least, in the very least, be able to buy into it, regardless of any pre-existing conditions, regardless of their ability, their income status, or working class status. And these kind of things where, you know, if we truly believe in the American dream, that anybody from any walk of life, no matter how poor your family is, can succeed, then we should have these opportunities for people to rise to the top and get good health care so that they can rise to the top.
Universal health care, or as many would describe it, Medicare for all, it would work very much like Medicare does for those who are older Americans. A lot of people mm-hmm. like the idea. Mm-hmm. The problem, the challenge with universal health care is how to pay for it. How right. would this work? How would you pay for it?
Well, first of all, there's many different ways to pay for it. And in the traditional view that of I don't want to pay for other people's health care is very limited. First of all, public education, we all pay for it because whenever a job hires people, they hire workers who are skilled and educated. And no one questions how we're going to pay for other people's education just because I don't have kids or just because I don't have anybody going to school. Health care, you can pay for it via a combination of fees and offsets. For example, SCHIP also right now is being paid for by the Cigarette Restitution Fund from tobacco taxes. And, you know, I think we as a society have ability to pay for it from a combination of taxes and fees and usage services, and also reducing costs. First of all, right now, America spends 20% of its healthcare system on administration overhead and complete waste, while other countries spend only 3%. That is a six-fold or more waste in our healthcare system that can be easily recouped. And currently, you know, in terms of healthcare, I don't even know how much seeing a doctor at whether it's UPMC or Geisinger or some other healthcare facility for anything from the common cold to hip replacement, I have no idea how much that costs. There's no competition in the system whatsoever. And so there's so much excess and waste, and health insurance, you know, it can be spread out in ways that actually can reduce costs by spreading the risk out.
I do want to get on to some other issues, sure. Cover as many as we can, but I think it's important that we follow up on this. When you say taxes and fees, are you talking about increased taxes and fees?
No, not necessarily income taxes. It can be fees on unhealthy things like sugar-sweetened beverages, which is currently well discussed, and there's bipartisan proposals. Just like tobacco
tax. Mainly soda tax in Philadelphia.
Right. Soda taxes. And we use tobacco taxes to pay for children's health insurance. And that's bipartisan. No one really argues against that. And there's, again, taxes and fees are reducing the cost. Because currently there's also a medical system that's very billing very perverse that's basically rewards unlimited billing for diseases and ailments as opposed to actual quality health care.
I want to move on to as many issues as we
sure.
can. The economy apparently is in good shape right now. Unemployment is low, but the jobs that have been created over the past 10 years are not as high paying, for the most part, as what Americans have been used to. What can Congress do to maintain that healthy economy and provide for better paying jobs?
Well, first of all, and that's very true, that workers' wages have not kept up with inflation or productivity gains. The U.S. has gained in productivity on a dramatic
I always try
scale.
To be true and accurate with what I say.
Yes, yeah. No, your stats are very key. And the thing is, workers' wages have fallen behind. And I think it's also because of the currently declining power of unions that workers are not able to bargain collectively as before. And, you know, minimum wage has completely stagnated and there's been no action federally for most part to catch up with inflation.
You'd support a minimum wage increase
absolutely.
And, to what?
To $15 an hour in many places and with a phase-in, obviously. But I think these cost of living adjustments, you know, the cost of living in New York is different than the cost of living in rural Pennsylvania, obviously. But I think there should be cost of living adjustments that we should keep pace with the inflation at each location and make sure that these minimum wage protections and health care protections that come. There's so much more than just income. There's also the ability not to get fired, not to get kneecapped right before where your benefits kick in. For example, some companies, like big companies like Walmart, has been well known to kneecap people's hours right before they become benefits eligible. So that's part of it's more than just how many dollars an hour, but also the ability to control your schedule and ability not to be kneecapped as a part-time worker before you get benefits. There's so many other things that comes with collective bargaining and the power of unions.
You, and I'm sure you've heard the argument against raising the minimum wage, is that it costs jobs, that if you raise the minimum wage, that those who pay minimum wage now, or maybe even a little above it, will not hire as many people, and you're hurting the low-income people that actually need that those kind of jobs. What's your response to that?
Well, at the same time, if you don't hire people, you're not going to grow your business. And, you know, everyone says, the Republicans oftentimes say, I built that. You know, this is my company, I built that. But they don't realize that they're built on the labor of workers that they need and the public education that educated these workers and healthcare that ensure these workers can go to work and stay on work and work reasonable hours without suffering and, you know, and getting very sick. So I think there's they should realize the greater spillover effects of full-time employment. Full-time employment yields way more productivity for their company. Healthy, educated workers who are maximally productive can actually yield more productivity for companies than workers that are working three or four jobs, getting sick, and, you know, oftentimes have to take off work because they have to take care of their child.
What can Congress do about that, or a member of Congress?
Well, first of all, I think it's not just wages. It's not just worker. It's also protection for workers' hours. It's also make sure people get good health care, and health care that is independent of whether someone is laid off or not, so that workers, they can actually swing for the fences. You know, think about it. You can swing for the fences if you have really good health care as a baseline. And I think, obviously, minimum wage, you know, fighting against the right to work legislations that have been really handicapping unions. And altogether, take a vision about labor and work that goes beyond just, oh, how many hours, you know, dollars and cents of how many hours, but because your worker productivity can increase dramatically. And it can also spur innovation when you know, healthcare is also already part of the benefits package. And you know, let's just take entrepreneurship, for example. First of all, if you had a great idea for starting something, but you can't leave your job because right now your daughter is sick, she has cancer, and you can't afford to quit your job to start your own business as an entrepreneur because you can't afford to lose the health care. Well, first of all, you're being locked into a job that makes your family suffer. And also, if only you had the opportunity to open to start in that business and still make sure your daughter has health insurance for her cancer disease, then think of the economic boom that is. That is actually, to the as Republicans say, freedom. And if you had that health care as a baseline, that freedom allows the economy to expand. You can actually start brand new ideas and businesses and startups without the worry of being tied down to just a single job. And I think that economic boom, that kind of sense of freedom, that's the ultimate sense of freedom for an economy that's able to boom. And most jobs, vast majority of jobs in our economy is created by these small business people. And so I'm very supportive of a lot of these things that support worker stabilization and people being able to have the freedom to quit their jobs and not worry about health insurance.
The recent mass shooting at the high school in Parkland, Florida, has many calling for more restrictions on guns. What are your thoughts on guns?
Well, I think we need a lot of gun control issues resolved. And I am for gun control, for the universal background checks, mandatory waiting times, bans on bump stock, bans on a lot of assault weapons, if possible, especially in urban areas. I think we may need some urban-rural, you know, balancing of some of these issues, because guns in urban areas is oftentimes a much bigger problem. But also, we often neglect mental health care. And mental health care is one of those issues that if you neglect it, it's like if you forget to plug one hole out of all the holes that are in this leaky ship, your ship is still going to sink and you're not going to solve this all. And one of the key things is universal mental health care, which obviously is tied into universal health care. And because mental health care is one of the key checks for a lot of these people who are on the fringes of society, has not been seen by a doctor in a long time, and has a lot of these strange, crazy impulses to shoot up people. So I think these kind of healthcare issues, in addition to gun control legislation, is also a very critical part for gun control.
Climate change is one of the challenges facing not just this country, but the world in general. I mean, this is a very controversial issue between Republicans and Democrats. But if you were elected to Congress, what would you support as far as fighting a changing climate?
Well, first of all, as a scientist, it irks me to no end that there is such denialism of climate change, especially under Scott Pruitt's EPA. And he's been decimating the EPA left and right from day one. So first of all, we can't even have a conversation about this without stopping, first of all, the denialism of climate change science, of the denialism of science in general, because whether it's EPA or CDC, there's a gag on, like, for example, the word evidence-based at the CDC. So in terms of climate change, we need to obviously, rejoin the Paris Accord. And the Paris Accord is not perfect, but I think joining this international consortium would improve America's world standing. And in terms of, green energy, we're not trying to talk about ending all coal jobs and oil jobs absolutely immediately and putting them all out of work. But, I agree, coal miners are suffering in many rural parts. But we need to transition them, just like we need to transition people from different technologies. Because right now we're abdicating by completely abandoning all green energy for initiatives. We're basically abdicating America's leadership in the next generation of technologies. It's like being so tied down to horse and buggies with the rise of cars. No, we have to resist the rise of cars. We have to stick with horse and buggies. But at some point we realize our society changes. We don't run on horse and buggies anymore. And protection for horse and buggy drivers, it makes no sense whenever the technology is clearly showing renewable energy is the future. And there's so many jobs, so many new jobs, economy jobs, that we can seize and take hold if we only reach out and not be closed-minded to these opportunities. And I think we just need to get off our anxiety from oil and coal and be able to seize the new opportunities. And I think the coal miners out there will see that there's so many opportunities for them as well in this new economy focused on green energy.
We only have about 2 minutes left. I want to thank you very much. I mean, we only touched on a few issues, and there are so many others we'd like to talk about. As I mentioned, you have three opponents in the Democratic primary. Why are you a better candidate than those other three?
That's a very good question. Well, I think everyone has... among us four have served our country in some way, but I think public leadership and passion. My only motivation in life is to improve public health and various issues related to the public. Because I've come from a family that came from nothing in terms of child poverty and opportunity, and I understand the potency of the American dream and how it's slipping because I've lived it. I've been on the good. Receiving end of Goodwill and Salvation Army programs. And so, A, I've lived the American dream, and I don't want to slip away from next generation. And two, all my initiatives, whether it's building a 6-million-person cancer campaign, whether it's taking on big pharmaceutical companies, holding them accountable when they knew the risks of their dangerous drugs, or whether it's preventing Flint lead poisoning communities, I led these projects. So I've led these projects from the front. I built these initiatives, I founded these programs, and I feel like I have that leadership experience to take that as a leader of this district.
Whichever of the four of you, the winner will take on incumbent Republican Congressman Scott Perry.
That's right.
Why do you think you're a better candidate for Congress than Scott Perry in about a minute or so?
Well, I think I stand for a lot of the issues that is plaguing this community. I think he's out of touch with a lot of the concerns of central Pennsylvanians, whether it's jobs, whether it's health care, whether it's, protecting workers like unions. He is one of those anti-union legislators out there. And in terms of climate change, he is a dinosaur as well. He's denying facts. So I think I, as a scientist, I bring facts. I listen. We use evidence to improve the public health and solve problems in our lives. And I think as a scientist, I'd be much more, rational and reasonable and able to listen to different issues and find what problems are there and what solutions can we solve together.
Dr. Eric Ding is a Democratic candidate for the U.S. House of Representatives in the 10th Congressional District. And since these districts are new, I want to point out that the 10th District covers Dauphin County and the eastern part of Cumberland County and northern portion of York County. Dr. Ding, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you very much. Pleasure.
And May 15th is the primary election here in Pennsylvania, so we encourage you to go to the polls. And if you're a registered Democrat and living in the 10th District, that you should look at those four candidates. Coming up on tomorrow's show, we're going to talk about whether Pennsylvania state legislature should be shrinking. We even actually have someone who says it should be bigger. That's on tomorrow's show, so tune in.